Committee on Health and Human Services Finance will come to order. There is a quorum present. Representative Albright moves the minutes from January 17th. Any additions, corrections, or subtractions? Seeing none, all those in favor of approval of the minutes, please say yes.
Yes.
Those opposed, no. Minutes are approved. Presentation today we have from the Minnesota Department of Human Services. We'll talk through a presentation, and this is the only presentation that we have today. But it is a very, very important one. We're happy to have Mr. Johnson with us, and please want to kick off your presentation. And if you wouldn't mind, since there's just one presentation today, if we could interrupt with questions and see how we're going for time, members can ask questions during the presentation. With that, take it away.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Chuck Johnson. I serve as Deputy Commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Human Services. So I'm going to spend some time today talking with you about our direct care and treatment programs. These are the programs, as the name implies, where we deliver services directly to individuals in need of service. And I am happy to take questions as we go along. I have a contingent of folks here to help me with answering questions as well, so hopefully we'll be able to be very responsive to the committee's interest today. When people think about direct care and treatment, they probably think about mental health, and most mental health services and most mental health treatment that's provided across the state is provided in communities and across different kinds of healthcare organizations, hospitals, community clinics, independent practitioners, and so forth. What direct care and treatment does is we really exist to provide a higher level of care, and particularly also to those clients who are committed to the commission. I'll talk more about this in some detail across our various programs. We really think of what we do at DHS as being the safety net to provide services for those who may not be cared for by others or others may not be able to care for. We have a range of services that we provide, and the bullets on this slide give you an idea of the four sort of major areas that we provide services in: mental health and substance abuse treatment services, and I'll talk about this. That involves a lot of different programs within our direct care and treatment. Community-based services, likewise, a number of different services there. Services mostly focus on people with disabilities, developmental disabilities. Forensic services, which are St. Peter programs focused on those who have criminal involvement. And then finally, the sex offender program. These are really, as I said, a range of different people we provide service for: people experiencing mental illness, people with disabilities, people experiencing substance abuse, or the co-occurring or coexisting conditions. Often people who may have also have behavioral challenges that make it harder for them to be served in the community or by other providers. And then, of course, we provide sex offender treatment to those committed to us for sex offender treatment. I do want to call attention to the picture on this page. This is the new building at the Minnesota Security Hospital. I know a number of you have been down there and toured and visited during the course of the construction. This is the phase one of the bonding proposal the governor proposed in 2014. His current bonding bill holds the second phase of the bonding down there, which would be the renovation and remodeling of the existing buildings. We're very pleased to have this new facility open and looking forward to the second phase of the bonding as well. I mentioned facilities statewide. We have about 175 facilities across the state in which we provide direct care services. Now, about 120 of those or so are individual homes, group homes, where we provide services mostly to people with disabilities, some people with mental illness. And then we have some larger facilities that folks are familiar with, the Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center, the Anoka Hospital, located there, our sex offender program that's at Moose Lake and also down at St. Peter, and of course at St. Peter also the security hospital and the forensic programming. But that far right little bubble on this slide really is where a lot of those facilities are, those at the individual homes that are scattered across the state. This just gives you our organizational chart for direct care and treatment. And I want to call out a few things here. We have a new health system CEO, Marshall Smith. I know a number of you have had a chance to meet Marshall. Marshall's been with us for about 6 months, comes to us from the private sector, a long history of experience working in hospital administration, health system administration. We think he really brings a good focus to the work we're doing in direct care and treatment and really brings us that kind of system-wide perspective that we need, and we're very pleased to have him on board with us. Directly under Marshall, you see the executive directors across the four areas that I just walked through. Carol Olson, our forensics executive, Wade Brose, our executive over mental health and substance abuse treatment, Don Chandler, who heads our community-based services, and Nancy Johnston, who is the executive over the sex offender program. Also wanted to call attention to one other box here, which is the chief quality officer. This is a new position that Marshall created after he came in as CEO to really focus our quality efforts across the system and take a system-wide perspective. All of this is done really with the goal in mind to give patients and clients the care they need in the most appropriate and most therapeutic and integrated setting possible. This reiterates a couple things I've already said. We serve about 13,000 people in a given year, about 13,000 last year, and it's been fairly consistent around that. And you can see a list here of the number of different kinds of conditions or illnesses that we would treat and provide care for in our programs. And, of course, also a big part of what we do, and I'll talk about this in a little more specificity, is provide treatment to those who have come in contact with the criminal justice system, that forensic function that we play in interaction with the criminal justice system, and then also those who are in need of sex offender treatment. As I said before, I think the most important thing is that we really provide treatment to those, care for those who can't be treated or cared for elsewhere, or who are committed to the state and need a level of treatment that we can provide in our facilities. This just gives you the pages in your budget narrative book. I believe you have a book, or at least some of you do, or maybe you have an online book. I'm not sure what version you have it in at this point. But these are the budget narratives that if you want to learn more about any of these programs, that's a real good explanation. Gives you the fiscal detail as well as an explanation of the program.
Excuse me, Commissioner. Representative Loeffler has a question. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Deputy Commissioner Johnson. As I recall, the community-based services really kind of were formed when a lot of the former state hospitals, like at Faribault, or Brainerd, and other places, were being closed and converted to prisons or other facilities. And in order to provide continuity of care for those residents and continued employment for the people working there, they tended to be located, as I recall from a map, really clustered around those locations, which was fine because that was the long-term home of those individuals. But I'm wondering now that families don't give up their family member like they did 40, 50 years ago, and that they want them close to home, how much have we been shifting that service system? It really wasn't targeted at the most needy. Back in those days, it was just that's what you did with adults with developmental disabilities or intellectual issues. And so to how has the system evolved to changing to our community-based integrated sort of system and locating the services where people are needed?
Commissioner Johnson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Loeffler. We have made adjustments over time. Some of it's been kind of slow. We have been working over the last couple of years to really create a stronger focus within particular MSOC's area on those more safety net clients. As you said, a lot of the services we've provided with the community-based services were kind of a legacy of the closure of the regional treatment centers and the deinstitutionalization of people with developmental disabilities. And so we created the group homes, often clustered around those cities, and provided employment to our employees, many of the employees from the regional treatment centers. We continue to have that legacy of somewhat location and somewhat the type of people we care for. We progressively are caring for more and more people who have difficult challenges beyond those that you might see in a privately run group home for folks with disabilities. And have changed accordingly in terms of how we staff, what kind of locations we look for, and what kind of homes we're leasing or in some cases purchasing in order to provide that kind of care. So we're kind of in a halfway point right now. I think folks will recall that we came to the legislature last year with a request for funding for MSOCs to help with that transition. I have a little update later in the slide presentation where I'll talk about where we're at on bringing the cost of MSOCs down, but also trying to get it focused appropriately on those that most make sense for state care at this point and where we are with our journey on deinstitutionalization.
Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Johnson. Representative Franzen has a question.
Yes, hi. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner, I am wondering, regarding the community-based services, do you have an idea of how many facilities of the home-based community services, the homes themselves, have closed? I know that I had one close in my district, and it really created a nightmare situation for families of where to place those young girls.
Commissioner.
If you could elaborate a little bit.
Mr. Chair and Representative France, I don't have that information with me. We have made some closures over the course of the last several years. We try always to work with the family, to work with the individual, to find a placement that's going to work for those individuals. So I could get you more information on what the closure patterns looked like over the last several years. I think we report that to the legislature on a regular basis, so we could probably aggregate some of that information for you.
Representative France.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then with a follow-up on the closings, could you provide the body with what the reasons are for the closings?
Mr. Chair, absolutely.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, the first several slides I'm going to walk through are kind of the baselining of what we do within direct care and treatment, and then I move into a set of slides that are a little bit more about kind of what's going on now, some of the progress we've made over the last couple of years, where we are relative to some of the appropriations that were made last year and some of the activity that we promised to put in place coming out of last legislative session. So the first part here is just going to be some overview of some of our services. Mental health services, there's a lot on the slide. Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center, this is the Anoka Hospital. This is a hospital, psychiatric hospital, where we care for people needing high-level psychiatric care. We have we've been running a census of around 95. We're budgeted at about 110. Been running a little bit lower because of the acuity of the patients that we're caring for, the need for a number of them to be on 1-to-1 or 2-to-1 kind of staffing ratios. And so we have been running a little bit lower over the last year or so at Anoka. This is where most of the 48-hour rule folks go. For folks who are not familiar, the 48-hour rule was passed even 2014, requires that when a court commits someone to us from a jail, we need to accept that person into our care within 48 hours of that commitment. Community behavioral health hospitals, we have six of those across the state. These are also provide psychiatric care. It's shorter term generally than we might see at Anoka. Perhaps a little bit less challenging patients, although the acuity of these patients is relatively high as well. Those are in Alexandria, Annandale, Baxter, Bemidji, Fergus Falls, and Rochester. These are the hospitals I'll talk about this a little bit later that we're in the process of staffing up based on funding that we were provided last year. Child and Adolescent Behavioral Health Services Program. This is a program in Willmar. It's a hospital that provides care to adolescents and children. This has been one that we've discussed over the last couple of years, the fate of this program. We have recently worked with the landlord. We did have a message from the landlord about a year and a half ago that he was going to kick us out of the building we were in Willmar. We are now working with him on extending that lease for another 2 years, which will give us some ability to figure out the future of the CABS program. I would also note that the governor has included a new CABS facility in his bonding bill in Willmar. We run four what are called IRTS programs, Intensive Regional Treatment Services. These are kind of a step down for people with mental illness. So once they've moving out of a hospital level of care, they're not quite ready to go to the community. They still need 24-hour observation and care. These are run privately as well. We run four of them in St. Paul, Brainerd, Wadena, and Willmar. And these are usually shorter stays. We have about 80 days on a stay in the IRTS right now. And then we place people hopefully into the community after they've stabilized through their stay in the IRTS. Myth Homes, Minnesota.
Commissioner Johnson.
Yeah.
On the IRTS facilities, how many total beds do we have? Are they full? And you said up to 80 days. What's a normal patient flow like through an IRTS?
Sure, I'm going to have to find the bed capacity or average daily census information for you. I don't have that right in my presentation.
That'd be fine if you want to follow up with that. And then if you could just, you know, from a system-wide priority level of how that fits in, where do you, and we're looking at trying to increase beds just from a policy perspective, where does the department want to go, and where do you think that we get the best value as we're adding in the in the continuum of care.
And Mr. Chair, I'm going to ask Mr. Brose to come down and help me address this. I'll get a start on and then ask him to fill in. I think there's great value in having the IRFs facilities and having the step down. This is part of our issue now with being able to move people out of Anoka and St. Peter. We have roughly 40% or so, or maybe up to half, Mr. Brose will know better, of our patients in Anoka who don't meet hospital level of care. That is, they don't need to be in a hospital. We want to get them into the community, but we can't make that transition. And IRTS is a key service for helping to fill that gap. And I'll let Wade fill in more on that.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Wade Brose. I'm the Executive Director for the Mental Health and Substance Abuse Treatment Services Division of the Department of Human Services. As Mr. Johnson was alluding to, we have four IRTS facilities in the state. Each of them are licensed for 16 beds. They're an appropriated service, and our current appropriation supports us serving 12 individuals at each of those sites at this time. So on any average day, our average daily census is around 10 per site, total of 40 in the facility, depending on admissions, discharges, and timing of those.
Thank you, Mr. Ross. And just as we're looking at trying to, we've got capacity issues at Anoka, we've got capacity issues in hospitals, and when we're looking at trying to add space, you know, from a value perspective, looking at the whole state, we understand that we need to add capacity, but where do we get the most value, or where does the agency think that we need to add capacity to give us the best value?
Mr. Chair, thank you. I think there's value in building an entire continuum. The individuals at AMRTC or within my division that need to be discharged or are ready for discharge need a wide variety of discharge options, anywhere from independent living with supports to IRTS facilities, to adult foster homes, et cetera. So I think there's a discussion and analysis to be had around what is the best value when we have capacity needs in each of those areas.
All right, thank you. Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is kind of along the same line. And by the way, thanks for what you do. I know this is a difficult group to work with in many cases, and appreciate your efforts. Do you have a process of looking at success rates of the programs that you fund in terms of recidivism rate and success rates, and also evaluating the cost? So, okay, for this dollar amount, we're getting this success rate and this recidivism rate. Do you evaluate the programs that you fund on that? And then I got a follow-up question.
Commissioner Johnson.
I'm Mr. Chair and Representative Grunhagen. I would have to get more information on exactly what we do to evaluate. I know that we certainly look at are always looking at things like length of patient stay, and the shorter the stay that we can get someone stabilized and move them on to a less more integrated environment, that's always the goal. So as Mr. Bro said, the extent we have people that are in Anoka or St. Peter who don't need to be there, that's a metric that we're monitoring on a regular basis and working to figure out how to get those individuals moved into the community or into some lower-level care. So that's a strong focus, certainly. Within community-based services, really part of it is looking at are we providing a function that is really useful within what the state system more broadly needs, kind of going to Representative Loeffler's question about, you know, what is the role of what we do on the state side versus what the private sector can do and we don't need to be involved in. We certainly measure treatment metrics around our substance abuse, programs, and we could share that with you as well. And so those are the kinds of things when we're in a treatment service, we're looking more at are we being successful in treatment and moving people on to the next stage so they're not needing to be at as high a level of care. That's really the metric that we're focused on.
Okay. Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Chair Dean. Yeah, the follow-up question then would be, do you look at comparative data in terms of cost and results with what other states are doing, and in terms of capacity, do you ever work where appropriate? I understand some of these individuals wouldn't be appropriate to work with private sector organizations such as Teen Challenge that have a very high success and low recidivism rate and are very cost-effective in terms of the treatment they provide?
Commissioner Johnson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Grunhage, I'm not sure we've done a lot of comparison with other states that have similar kinds of state-operated systems. I know we did some comparisons around our St. Peter Security Hospital with similar kinds of hospitals to evaluate really staffing levels. And that's something the proposal we brought forward last year, the governor brought forward last year, to add staff to St. Peter, really because we identified that our staffing ratio is significantly lower than similar kinds of hospitals in other states that are caring for a similar population, which is mentally ill and dangerous in the case of the security hospital. In terms of working with the private sector, we kind of view ourselves as being part of the overall system. So the private organizations have a role and we have a role. I think when you've mentioned Teen Challenge and substance use treatment, that's certainly an area where we've had a lot of conversations around, you know, is this a business that we need to be in? It is an enterprise business, which within the way we appropriate within the state government means you don't actually appropriate us money for it. They're actually a small appropriation for those programs. But generally, we live off of the same revenues like a private provider would. But we do also have in Minnesota commitments for people with substance use, and so there is a question of whether the commissioner needs to have a capacity for people who may be committed to her for that level of care. So we more work with them as partners in a system, not necessarily work with them directly on individual projects.
Just a clarification, Mr. Chair.
Representative Grunhage.
Oh, thank you, Chair Dean. And I guess what I'm saying is if you're faced with overcapacity, do you look to some of these other organizations like Teen Challenge to alleviate some of that capacity rather than leave this where appropriate? I understand some aren't appropriate, but it would help alleviate some of the bottleneck in the system, because I know from my local hospitals there's bottlenecks in the system.
Commissioner Johnson.
With some of these populations.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Grunhage, I guess I'd give two examples where that might be. So one is we have individuals that are, for instance, on a waiting list to get into one of our substance use programs. We may be working with the county who's making the placement to say, can you find another place to place this individual because we're not going to have a slot available. So in that way, we will work through the placing authority, which is the county or sometimes a managed care organization. But also, when you get to the higher level of care, like psychiatric care, we have certainly entered into conversations with other psychiatric hospitals around how we can share and work together on ensuring that they're using their capacity to the best extent they can, and so that we can focus our capacity on those that most critically need what we can offer at Anoka or St. Peter. And that has been a challenge with psychiatric beds across the state, and certainly in smaller communities it's been a challenge where they have individuals that they need to get into one of our facilities where there's some challenges around that.
Thank you, Commissioner Johnson. Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned when you started off that there were a number of ERTS beds that were private. I know there's one in Mankato. I believe it's I can't think of the organization now. How many beds, ERTS facilities or beds are there in the private sector?
Mr. Bros.
Mr. Chair, I will have to get that information and get back to you. I can only speak to the number of beds I have in direct care and treatment.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, we do license the ERTS facilities, so we can get that information pretty easily for you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I think I was mentioning the Myth Homes. Myth Homes are kind of a unique service that we provide in Minnesota to children who are suffering from severe emotional disturbance or serious acting out behaviors. And it's actually a form of foster care, specialized foster care. So kids who need a safe place to live with a care provider who understands how to care for their needs, we can place children. As you can see from the pie graph, it's a very small number of children we serve. And then forensic services, which is, I think often we talk about forensics in the security hospital interchangeably, but really forensics is a set of programs. And these are really the services we provide around individuals who've been in contact with the legal system through committing a crime in some fashion or being charged with the crime. These are the individuals who are committed to us for competency restoration, for example. That is a role that we provide to provide treatment and then education to determine if an individual who's experiencing mental illness can be brought to competency, that is, can be brought in to go to trial, to experience the legal system and understand what's going on, or make a determination that perhaps they're not competent. Obviously, the security hospital is the biggest facility within this within the forensics area. This is where we serve people who are committed to us as mentally ill and dangerous, also provide some services under competency restoration as well. Forensic transition services, this is, as it sounds, the transition services. So many of the people that are committed to us and go to St. Peter at Security Hospital as mentally ill and dangerous stay with us for a number of years. This is not a short-term program. Security Hospital, even though it's called a hospital, is actually not a hospital. It's a residential treatment program. And so at the time that people are we believe we've reached a point in treatment where we can move people back to the community, we often will put them into transition services first. And that's a little bit more freedom in their living, more visits out into the community, more of an opportunity to start experiencing that transition so they can get ready for a placement back into the community. And so it's a service that really is part of the continuum, but is right on campus in how we provide those services. We also run a forensic nursing home for patients who need nursing-level of care. People are committed to us as sex offenders, as mentally ill and dangerous. We also take transfers from the Department of Corrections into the nursing home. And then, as I mentioned, the competency restoration program, which I'll say a little bit more about because we made some changes to that last year and right in the process of getting that implemented. The next slide is our substance use services. We served about 1,000 people last year through the six programs that you see listed here that we run in the substance use area. We did actually make a change in this program in the middle of the year you're looking at, the middle of fiscal year 16. And you may recall this was another initiative we brought forward last year in the legislative session. Was to reduce the census or the number of beds that we would staff for in each of these care programs, as they're called, to 16 beds. And that was done because 16 beds means that under Medicaid we are not considered an IMD or an Institute for Mental Disease, which means we can receive Medicaid reimbursement. And so it helped our revenue picture in running these programs. These programs are called Care Addiction Recovery Enterprise. So if you see the acronym CARE, that's what we're talking about. It's our substance abuse services. Really focusing on chemical use, some co-occurring conditions, as well as really providing lifelong growth and opportunity for people to transition back into the community. We provide both inpatient treatment and outpatient through our care facilities. Community-based services. We have four major services that sit under the community-based services. These are residential community-based services. Much of this is the residential services, about 120 homes that we have across the state that we operate. And you can see in the sliver of the pie here about 500 people that we serve through that service in 2016. And as I said in responding to Representative Loeffler's question, this was a bigger piece of the pie. More people in the past, we've kind of skinnied down. We're focusing more on those that need safety net level of care that other providers can't care for, and increasingly people with mental illness along with disabilities. Vocational services, this is, again, similar to services that other providers provide. It really is focused on helping people with disabilities get to work. We are proud of this service in the sense that we, across all of our vocational services for people with disabilities, our goal is to move people as much as they can, as much as possible, to working in the community, to having a job in the community where they're integrated with other people, not in the sheltered workshop environment where they're often paid the subminimum wage. Within our own vocational services, we have about 79% as of October who are working in the community. So we've really tried to make that an emphasis consistent with Olmstead as we push private providers to follow that lead and to make better use of community employment opportunities.
Excuse me, Commissioner Jensen, Representative Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner here, I just want to, if you could go back to page 4 of and then the mental health services section there. All right, I guess it's slide number 8. It's my page 4, sorry. So I am just wondering what is being done to increase the mental or the Minnesota intensive therapeutic homes. Currently, there are no beds available, and I'm sure you're well aware that kids are being warehoused in hospitals currently that don't need that type of level care. So what I'm wondering is, what is being done to expand the number of those beds? Currently, how many are there? And to help these kids get the appropriate care that doesn't require payment for the expensive inpatient services.
Commissioner Johnson.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to ask Mr. Bros to come up and help with that question as well.
Thank you. You know, as parents, you know, seeing their kids just sit in a hospital is devastating, heartbreaking, and expensive as well.
Mr. Bros.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There are a couple of things that the department is doing to address children in hospitals. We have, two sessions ago, the legislature passed the psychiatric residential treatment facility funding, and the mental health policy division is in the process of implementing those beds, which will alleviate some of the hospital need. And as far as the myth homes, Donovan Chandler is actually the executive who can address where we are developing those or not developing those within the state. So I'll turn it over to him if that's okay, Mr. Chair.
Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. I'm Donovan Chandler. I am the Executive Director of Community-Based Services, part of DHS. Mr. Chair, Representative, the MITH program is essentially in-home family foster care, where we employ one of the foster parents as a full-time employee. This allows us to provide wraparound services to them to take on some of the more difficult children. It has been difficult to get foster parents to take on that role. They are independently licensed through various licensing agencies. So it's been difficult to get people to take on some of these challenging children. Excuse me. Currently, we have not been at capacity until recently. The need, we are currently supporting 18 children. We do have a list of active, or not active currently, but foster parents who have been through work with the MITH program previously, and we can activate those parents when we have referrals. And at this point, we are supporting 18 individuals, and I don't have the information on how many referrals we have currently.
All right. Commissioner Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Community support services, I'm going back now to slide 10. Community support services under community-based services. This is essentially a service we provide to help ensure that people who are experiencing crisis are able to stay in the community. So it's really a crisis-based service. And to provide assistance to providers, both our own and private providers, who are struggling to provide an appropriate level of care for, or appropriate type of care for some an individual they're having some challenge with, often related to behaviors or co-occurring conditions. So we have mobile teams of people across the state that we tap to provide this service, as I said, across services provided to people with disabilities. And then finally, the biggest number on the slide in terms of people we serve is actually through our dental clinics. We have 5 dental clinics in Brainerd, Cambridge, Faribault, Fergus Falls, and Wilmer. These are really the dental clinics that we run, and we operate off of revenues for individuals who present challenges to private dentists to provide care to, people with disabilities, people with behavioral issues, people who have trouble experiencing a dentist in a community setting. And so there's specialized services to provide dental services to individuals with disabilities who need to have this kind of care. And finally, Mr. Chair, the 4 large areas that we operate sex offender treatment. We provide treatment for about 722 clients in the last year, or in our current census. People know we have a program in Moose Lake and a program in St. Peter. Essentially, Moose Lake is where individuals who are committed to us for sex offense treatment come initially for the treatment, and the first stage is a treatment are at Moose Lake. If they're able to progress through treatment, then they would move down to St. Peter. If they progress even further, then they get to this light blue slice of the pie here that's called community preparation services. So that's sort of how an individual would progress through the sex offender treatment. The community preparation services at 89 individuals is right now at capacity, and this is the highest level we've ever had in that treatment. Community preparation services is outside of the razor wire. It's similar to it's a transition service, essentially, to start working with the individual clients to prepare them for the potential for a provisional discharge or a full discharge back to the community. This is also an area where the phase of bonding that was passed in 2014 helped us expand by 30 beds. Those beds opened last fall. We filled them immediately. And so we don't really have capacity right now in this program. The people who move to community preparation services are moved there via a court order. So we don't have control necessarily over how many people come into CPS. And so as we go forward, this is going to be a continuing challenge to manage the population that we expect will continue to increase within community preparation services. As you can also see on the slide, we do have a number of people who have been provisionally discharged. We have one full discharge, we have seven who have been provisionally discharged, and we have six who have been provisionally discharged and we're still working on housing for them. I probably don't need to tell the committee that finding housing in the community is a real challenge. And so this has continued to be one of those efforts that we're making to try to find placements for individuals who the court has said are now ready to move to the community. I assume folks are also aware of the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals decision that was handed down a couple of weeks ago that overturned the district court ruling that said the program was unconstitutional. And so that's a welcome ruling, and we're certainly very happy to find that we are not in the position of having that the decision that was made by the district court still hanging over us. At the same time, we know that we still have to manage the program and meet the challenges of people moving through treatment into the community preparation services and further into discharge. So those challenges aren't going to go away simply because we have a favorable court ruling at this point. We think we'll continue to work toward continuing to improve the sex offender treatment program going forward.
Excuse me, Commissioner Johnson. Representative Albright has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm looking at the slide number 11, talking about the discharge. I'm just wondering if you could elaborate in terms of the timeline for how long those with provisional discharge and living in the community have been in the communities, how long and what has been the frequency with those six that have provisional discharge orders but are awaiting housing, and how long has the one client been fully discharged?
Mr. Chair and Representative Albright, I don't have that information with me. If Nancy Johnson has it, she could provide it, or else we could provide it in writing. Nancy's coming to the table, so she must know more than I know.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Johnson. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Good afternoon. My name is Nancy Johnston. I'm the Executive Director for the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. Representative, you were wondering about the number of folks that are already in the community in terms of timeline. Our client that's been in the community the longest is coming up on 5 years in March, and the other six have been more recent. We have an individual who has been, two actually, who have been in a foster care placement for about 2 years. And we have two gentlemen who reside in a halfway house currently in St. Paul, and they have been within the last year. And then the individual who was fully discharged was this past summer. I don't have the exact date. Mr. Terhar, who moved home to be with his father in the St. Cloud area. So he's been out for several months, and we don't have the responsibility, of course, to supervise him. We're supervising all of the other men. The six who are waiting, they have received a provisional discharge order, and we have been trying to find appropriate placement for all of those men. We had some lined up, and things have fallen through. As Mr. Johnson said, it's a challenging it's a challenging project finding housing and appropriate housing for the clients. They have different needs. Some of the men that we serve obviously need a more supervised setting like foster home or supportive housing. But we have many, many, many clients who are conventional clients who could live on their own someday and work full-time and contribute to their cost of care.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to that point, in reflecting upon the Eighth Circuit opinion and the events leading up to that, I'm just wondering if the whole concern about the constitutionality acted as somewhat of a catalytic agent for those 14 people. And I'm just wondering if now that that issue has been resolved, I'm wondering if that discharge process will continue at a similar pace, or in your opinion, will it be more will it slow down in light of maybe not the urgency with regard to the issue before the court pursuant to, you know, not hearing the hearing or the judgment?
Ms. Johnston.
Mr. Chair, Representative, although I can't speak for the Supreme Court Appeals panel or what their orders might be in the future, as you stated, we have seen in the last couple of years, obviously, seven provisional discharges, actually 13 with those that are waiting inside the perimeter. We have no reason to wonder either way in terms of if that pace will continue or if it will slow down. It's really up to the courts to decide. The cases are going in front of the court. Men are petitioning. That hasn't slowed down. That has stayed pretty constant in the last couple of years.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And Ms. Johnston, as long as we have you down for the benefit of new members, maybe you could just talk about the differences between the Moose Lake facility and the St. Peter facility and how they relate to one another, and then the important difference between the St. Peter hospital and the sex offender treatment program at the same, basically on the same piece of property but totally separate, for members that haven't gotten the tour yet of all three, and maybe just an overall census number of how many people we're at right now and how they're distributed with those two facilities.
Certainly. Thank you, Mr. Chair. In Moose Lake, we have approximately 410 clients. They reside in two very large buildings. One of the buildings is six units, 25-bed units, and the other building is a 400-bed facility with five very large wings. As Mr. Johnson mentioned earlier, the Moose Lake facility is our intake facility, so men who are newly committed or on hold status waiting to be committed are admitted to the Moose Lake facility. We have about 85% participation rate in terms of clients deciding to participate in treatment at any given time, and around 15% or about 100 men who refuse at any given time. That's their right to engage in treatment or not. If they choose to engage in treatment, they enter our introductory phase one, and begin their journey through our three-phase system. At Moose Lake, we house those that are in phase one, those that are newly admitted, those who refuse to participate, I mentioned a moment ago, those men who are in treatment but need assisted living care, are elderly, medically compromised, et cetera. Also those men who are in the beginning stages of phase two, which is the second phase, obviously, of the program. Once they're into phase two, they're evaluated by a panel to move to the St. Peter campus. So that travel down to our southern campus occurs based on the progress and level of treatment that they've made and the level of change that they've made along the way. Once they are approved to move to St. Peter, they move to the secure perimeter within two buildings at our St. Peter site behind a secure perimeter. two buildings. One building is about 112 beds, and those men and one woman reside in that building that are cognitively impaired. It's our alternative program. They have special needs, and we have specialized services for that group. The other building is called the Shantz Building, and that building is 144 beds, and that encompasses the men who are in later phase two and phase three. So they're getting towards the point in time that they will possibly move out and be transferred into community preparation services. We provide vocational, educational, recreational, and specific sex offender treatment to all of the clients that choose to engage. Once a man actually can petition every 6 months if he so chooses, but as men progress through treatment and make a decision to petition to their next transfer to CPS, Community Preparation Services, or provisional discharge, they do so. Those that petition for CPS and are granted the transfer by the courts move from the secure perimeter into community prep services right on campus. The campus, as Representative Dean mentioned, is shared by Forensic Services and the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. The Minnesota Sex Offender Program is on the lower part of the campus, but so are several of the forensic patients. We're both in the middle of a very large bonding project in that forensics is hopefully going to be able to continue their renovation of buildings on the upper campus, which would completely separate the sex offender population from the forensics population. For MSOP, our part of that bonding project involves the expansion of community preparation services. Last year, we added 30 beds. We're up to 89. We are at capacity. We have approximately five men who have received a transfer order but are waiting inside the perimeter. I can't follow that court order because I have no beds left inside CPS. The phase two part of bonding of the governor's request will involve 50 additional beds in CPS to then be able to honor those court orders and move clients into CPS once we have those beds available. We do not, forensics and MSOP do not share services, but we do share the physical, the land, if you will, on that campus. And our ultimate goal is and intent is to separate the populations completely from lower campus and upper campus.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
All right. Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, slide 12 provides some high-level financial information. This is the total spending on direct care and treatment programs for fiscal year 2016, about $416 million. As I mentioned, I was going through the presentation, I touched on a couple of times that we have some services we run that are called enterprise services, meaning you don't appropriate us the dollars. We basically earn the revenue and then pay for those services. So about $278 million of this $416 are dollars that you appropriate, and the remainder is mostly the enterprise services and a few special revenue accounts.
Excuse me, Commissioner Johnson. I'm sorry. Representative Grunhagen had a question before, and I...
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Really, it was for the...
Ms. Johnston?
Yeah, Ms. Johnston, yeah, on the sex offender program. And it has to do with a constituent of mine whose son is in the program. And I know this is a difficult area, but... And again, this is secondhand information from the parents, okay? But I got to know them. Their son's in the program. And they explained to me what their son or how their son is being treated in the program in terms of trying to rehabilitate him as a sex offender, okay? Again, secondhand information, the son is telling the parents this, okay? If I were to repeat what those parents told me in this committee room, it would shock the sensibilities of the majority of people in this room, okay? Let me just say it did involve showing explicit pornographic pictures to a young man in the program, okay? I'll leave it at that. I'll leave off the rest of the stuff. My question is, and again, I'm representing my constituent here, okay, and who was very distraught, the mom and the dad, when they talked to me at length, probably close to an hour. I stood outside their house. They don't let politicians in the house. I said, no, I'm just kidding. But does anybody in the program evaluate what is being done in terms of treatment to these sex offender programs, to these sex offenders, and if there's any effectiveness whatsoever? Quite frankly, when they explained to me, and again, it's secondhand information, so I'll take it with a grain of salt, okay? What was being done to their son, and again, I'm not an expert, but I would say it could create deviancy in people, not cure them. And so who evaluates these techniques that are applied to these sex offenders, whether it's helpful, hurtful, or has no effect at all? That's my question.
Thanks, Representative Gruenhagen. Ms. Johnston, I think, I don't know if Representative Gruenhagen, you've had a tour of either facility or been down, but I do know they go through some of the things that they do for therapy and also for vocational training and lots of other things that you can see on a tour, and I'm sure the commissioner can arrange that, and perhaps for others who would from the committee who'd like to go down.
I would appreciate a visit and be able to ask more direct questions to some of the individuals involved, because it gave me great consternation when the parents told me what was being done to their son in terms of treatment.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we would love to take you on a tour of either or both facilities. I can't really speak to this particular person. I'm not sure who we're speaking about, nor would I do that here, but I would be happy to maybe outside of this room have further conversation with you and maybe answer questions.
Why don't you contact my LA and make an appointment? I'd appreciate your time, at least a few minutes. Thank you.
Thanks, Representative Gruenhagen. And for members, we do have AMRTC and the MSH staffing levels, which is really a big budget item that was in the governor's request last year, kind of came in late, and it's going to be, I believe, again, and a very, very large ticket item that we want to look at for staffing and effectiveness. So I want to make sure that Commissioner Johnson has enough time to cover that and also answer questions from members, because that was a significant change in the budget request in the last term, and I'm sure we'll be on the table again. So Commissioner Johnson, if you want to continue.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. That's a great transition. I was going to say the same. That I'm moving into some slides now to talk a little bit about what we brought forward last year, what progress we've made there, where we think we still have some needs that have to be addressed. This graphic you may recognize for those of you around last year from our request last year, which brought forward a, really we called it a crisis package. We felt like we were at a place with direct care and treatment where we had some really specific needs that we needed to address in order to provide care, ensure the patient and staff safety in our facilities. And so as Representative Dean indicated, we brought forward a large proposal. Really focused on improving quality and therapeutic care, the movement of people through the system, which is a key part of ensuring that we're using beds in the best way possible, and a big piece towards stabilizing funding. When we talk about improving capacity, quality, and movement, we're really talking about how we can ensure that we are providing individualized and person-centered care across all of our services. We have the best practices, we're meeting our licensing standards, other compliance standards that we have, and that we're doing that in a way that's providing a safe environment, not just for the patients, but also for our staff. And I'll talk a little bit about safety for our staff later. I feel we've made some improvement there, but we obviously have a lot of work to do. And really, ultimately, increasing the face-to-face interaction that goes on between our staff and patients, that's how you accelerate treatment. That's how you move people through. And that gets to the staffing levels and reducing overtime and ensuring that when we need a one-to-one or a two-to-one, we're able to do that without having to stretch our staff to the limits of impacting safety. So what's listed here in the green bars are essentially the proposals that we brought forward last year on that topic. And then likewise on this slide, really related to stabilizing funding, we had two large proposals, one related to the DCT operating adjustment. That's essentially the funding that we need in order to continue to operate at the level we're at now, essentially to manage the increased costs of staff. So if staff, if there was a raise in the bargaining unit contract, increases in health care costs, pension costs, other things that we as an employer need to be able to provide. If we don't get an operating adjustment, we essentially have to reduce our staffing footprint in appropriated services because we don't have the money to be able to maintain our staff. And then we had, and I'll talk in more detail about this, a large request around a deficiency within our MSOX program. This slide shows the proposals the governor brought forward across that category we call capacity, quality, and movement through the system. And the two at the top are obviously the largest. The psychiatric bed proposal had a couple of main components to it. One was staffing up of our community behavioral health hospitals so we could have the full 16 every daily census maintained in each of those facilities in order to create more availability of beds. We had gotten to a point where we were only having 10 to staff to handle 10 to 12 patients on a given day within those facilities. Similarly, some increased staff for Anoka. And also within that proposal was a creation of a community-based competency restoration program at St. Peter. And I can talk a little bit more about what we did there. And then obviously there was a large request for Security Hospital, that's MSH, there on the second line, $22.3 million. That funding was not provided. And a couple of smaller pieces related to MSOP and the transition, focused transition efforts that we had asked for funding for, which were also not provided. In the area of stabilizing funding, the legislature did provide the funding that we requested in those two areas for operating adjustment and also to address the deficiency in Minnesota State Operated Community Services, or MSOX. So in total between this, we asked for about $105 million. We got about $62.7 million, so a little less than two-thirds of what we asked for last year. And as Representative Dean suggested, you'll be seeing some of these proposals again this year when the governor's budget comes out next year. And this slide sort of gives you an idea of that. If you just look at the biennium we're now all budgeting for, working toward the 18-19 biennium, last year, if all of what we'd asked for had been funded, it would have been a total of about $165 million, and what we actually received was the $70.7 million. So the biggest gap clearly being the staffing at the security hospital, but a few other areas where we have some potential gaps as well.
And Commissioner Johnson, I think one thing is important to follow through on is the deficiency funding that the legislature was presented with and approved before that was to augment staffing facilities. And following through on that, we'd said, hey, if we get this money, we're going to hire this many people, so we won't have as much overtime. This is how we're going to fill it through. Then circled back, said, how did we do with that deficiency funding? How many people did we add? And we said, well, actually, we had to use that to pay back this fund over here because we had to use that for deficiency funding. And I think it just brings up a policy problem, frankly, that we have when we're funding within the agency between funding sources or not funding programs, that we create our own deficiencies at times when we do that, and that the decisions are made retrospectively. And I found that a little bit frustrating, and probably need for more oversight and clarification in real time on where that money goes. So that if we give money to DHS to add people at a facility, they actually get added there at the ground level, not at mid-level and not in overtime, and not retrospectively paying back another fund. So I found that a little frustrating, and I want to try to prevent that in the future, but also bring members up to speed in real time on exactly what we are funding when we're funding a deficiency or prospectively in a budget.
Mr. Chair, the deficiency that was provided for the security hospital is a deficiency, meaning it was really to maintain the staffing levels that we had in place but weren't able to fund due to the deficiency in funding. We did, as you suggest, have other pressures, and we were holding vacancies for a while, therefore creating some pressure in other parts of the budget in order to maintain and to solve a deficiency in another part of the budget. But I do believe, and I know we provided this information, and we can provide it again. I don't have it here with me, of how we use the deficiency funding that was provided in the prior legislative session. But I certainly understand that under seeing where the dollars are going and ensuring that they're going to the staff as appropriated is something that we want to be able to follow through on and ensure that we're providing you with the information you need on that issue.
I want that report. The report he's talking about, I'd like to see that.
Okay. And we'll make sure that all the members have that.
Mr. Chair, talk a little bit about the security hospital and the progress that we're making there. Folks are aware that we were put on a conditional license that happened about 5 years ago. That was due to a couple of documented issues of abuse of patients and some ongoing policy violations. And it was a pretty severe action that was taken by the licensing division to put us on a conditional license. In addition to that, as we were working through that, the condition license was extended in 2013 and in 2014 due to some additional incidents. And we all know that there will be incidents in a hospital or in a facility like the security hospital. We are dealing with difficult patients, and we have staff that are always doing their best to try to provide care to those individuals, but it can be an environment that can be very challenging. But we do think we've taken some steps here that have really helped us in moving forward with the security hospital. We've trained staff around and through different iterations on person-centered care, how to identify imminent risk, how to handle situations when they're escalating, how to handle those situations without having to intervene in a way that's going to create safety issues for staff or for the patients we're caring for. I'm going to show you some slides around patient safety, staff safety. That has improved over the course of time. We're also getting better at just implementing better treatment across what we're doing within the security hospital. And a lot of folks have been working on just trying to become better at planning, documenting, communicating between treatment teams, really helping individuals be able to move through the program. A little bit of what you see on this slide is the conditional license was lifted in December. We are now a fully licensed facility. We're very pleased to have made progress out from that period where we're struggling with the conditional license. We also worked with our licensing division who had actually in the conditional license called out the idea of maybe we need a different way of looking at what the right licensing standards are for the security hospital. It's not like any other residential mental health treatment facility. It is a different animal. So we worked together, staff, labor, advocacy groups, management, key stakeholders, and developed a set of standards that we now have in place under a variance that apply just to MSH and standards that are specific to what we do within MSH. We think that'll help us going forward and have a much clearer understanding about what are the compliance conditions that we as an organization at the security hospital need to work against. And we're happy that we brought people together to do that. As I mentioned, we still are concerned about the staffing levels at Security Hospital and the fact that we did not receive the funding last year, and expectation that will be coming forward again from the governor. It affects safety, it affects overtime, it affects our treatment and the pace of treatment that individuals can experience. As I mentioned before, we did in trying to figure out what the sort of right level of staffing for a security hospital was, we went out and looked at other kinds of similarly situated state hospitals in other states that provide treatment to a similar population. And two of them were most similar, Oregon State Hospital and Fulton State Hospital, which is in Missouri, had staffing ratios of 3.3 staff to one patient, and we're currently at about 2.2 staff to one patient at the security hospital. So that was what was really driving the request we brought forward last year. We had worked with our labor partners on that request, and it was really to bring, as Representative Dina suggested, more care staff, more direct line care staff and clinicians in to help us with making further progress at MSH. AMRTC, the Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center, here we had similar kinds of compliance issues, this case with Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, the federal organization that oversees licensing of hospitals and also obviously oversees the permission around funding for federal funding sources. So here we're out of compliance with some issues related to patient care, safety, and some hospital operational issues. We worked with the licensors, which is the Department of Health, and with CMS to develop what's called a service improvement agreement. We are in that service improvement agreement now. That is something that helps us to essentially address the issues and to avoid what would be the ultimate penalty here were the federal government to pull its approval, which is the loss of federal revenue at AMRDC, which I believe is about $3.5 million a year or so. So we are making progress with the SIA. We have that in place now. We've hired a project manager who oversees all that work for us, really coordinates between the facility, our compliance office, our attorneys, our licensing area, others who are involved in this issue. We also, per the Service Improvement Agreement, have hired an expert consultant, and this is actually the Minnesota Hospital Association is our consultant. Their job is really to come in, and they've been with us for several months now and have been doing this work, analyzing the process and systems at Anoka, helping us figure out where we need to improve, where we need to do a better job of providing care, where we can do better at monitoring our quality in order to not have the compliance issues that we experienced with the CMS review. And then there's also a compliance consultant, which has just come on board, which is kind of the piece of the puzzle that really monitors what we're doing independently and reports back to CMS on whether we're making the progress that is expected here. So we put all this in place, and it's obviously part of what we're doing to try to maintain our licensure and try to maintain the federal reimbursement. But it's also really about a lot of help from the hospital association, the compliance consultant, for how we improve the care that we're providing, the treatment that we're providing at Anoka, and really trying to help that the culture of that organization adjust to the patients and the acuity of the patients that we're caring for now, which really has changed from where we were a couple of years ago.
Commissioner, Representative Liebling has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Johnson, I just wonder if you could say a word here about what's going on with the capacity at Anoka. I think you mentioned before that the census was down a little bit, but I'm just interested in, you know, are we building more capacity there, or what's going on in addition to these changes that sound very positive?
Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling, we're running an average daily census. We have been for the last year of around 95 or maybe a little bit more than that. We were initially budgeted for going into this year at 110 beds. We haven't maintained 110 beds in part because some of it is due to clinical staffing, not having the psychiatrists or the advanced practice nurses, the others that we need to help with the clinical side of care for the patients we're serving. But a lot of it has to do with the acuity of the patients that we're serving, and with more acute patients having more one-to-one or two-to-one staffing ratios, which means we don't have enough staff to be able to handle the other 15 beds, and in the environment to have the mix of having 15 more people in the facility and maintain a safe environment. So this is one where, to be honest, we really listen to our clinicians about what they're telling us about how many patients they can handle at a given time and trying to ensure that we make that right balance of maintaining a safe environment, even though we all know that 15 additional beds would help from a more systemic perspective.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, a few other items around what we've done on capacity and quality. I mentioned earlier one of the initiatives from the 2016 legislature that was funded was staffing for our community behavioral health hospitals. That results across the six of them in about adding about 200 FTEs in order to get all those hospitals up to a level where we have staffing to handle 16 beds. We've hired about 80 of those folks so far. We're in the process of hiring and putting in place the rest of them. This is kind of phased in over time, so we'll bring on the rest of the staff over the course of the year. And we're looking at starting in February, starting to bring the first hospital up to 16 beds and then moving forward where we're adding that bed capacity as we go forward and increasing our average daily census in those programs. So we're making some progress going forward on the CBHHs and getting that staffing in place to increase the bed capacity there. Opening a new competency restoration program in St. Peter, Minnesota. It is actually opening today. We have patients moving in this afternoon. So some of you will remember from last session, so the purpose of doing this is really to help us free up some more beds at Anoka and at the Security Hospital. Those two sites handle people who are committed to us for competency restoration now, but not everyone who's committed to us for competency restoration needs to either be at a hospital level of care like Anoka or in a secure environment like the Security Hospital. They could get that service at another facility. So what we proposed last year, and you all approved, was essentially setting up a community competency-based restoration program in St. Peter. It's off of the campus. We had two other buildings in St. Peter we were operating programs in. We had a CBHH and a CARE program. And we basically closed the CBHH, moved the CARE program into that building, and used that CARE building for the new building for our competency restoration program. So as of, I believe, December, we opened the new CARE program in the old CBHH building, and as of today, we're opening the competency restoration program in the old CARE building. And so that really provides another level of care. And we're starting out kind of slow. We're staffing that organization up, so we won't be up to the 30 or so beds that we want to have eventually. But it will be a way for us, hopefully, to relieve some of the pressure for people in Anoka or in the security hospital who could be served in that environment instead. So, again, as a way to try to open up some psychiatric beds. Staffing up CABS facility in Wilmer, I mentioned this earlier, the CABS facility is the program for child and adolescent behavioral health services. Because we had some uncertainty about the future of that program, we've been carrying very small census in that program, and there have been some staff attrition. With the understanding that we're now going to be able to sign a lease and continue our services for at least another 2 years, and the hope that if we can get approval around the governor's bonding proposal to have a new facility in Wilmer, we are now adding staff so we can add census to that program, because as was mentioned a little bit earlier, we have a number of children where this is the right place for them to be, and we want to have that capacity within our system. Moving patients to more integrated settings, we've made some progress. We did actually ask for some initiatives last year that would have helped with this that didn't get funded. We have had some reduction over the last couple of quarters, I know from our Olmsted reporting, in the number of people at Anoka who are do not meet criteria folks, which means we've been more successful at getting some of those folks out. But that still is a real work in progress, and we still definitely have issues with folks both in Anoka and St. Peter that we need to get into the community, and are continuing to experience challenges on finding placements and staffing placements and getting the funding wrapped around those individuals. I'll say a little bit more in another slide about some of the recruitment and retention issues, but this is an issue I mentioned. Marshall Smith, our new CEO, he's really focused around our recruitment, retention, and staffing issues within our facilities, and really brought some of that perspective from his work in the private sector and hospitals and health systems to help us come up with a better way of ensuring that we can maintain our staffing levels. I mentioned safety a couple times, and I promised you a slide. This is the slide. This shows the OSHA recordable cases. That's the blue line, and then the greenish line is the recordable aggressive behavior cases. And what you can see in 2016 is that the numbers are quite a bit down from where they were in 2015 or 2014. So that is definitely good news. And actually, 2016 is below the five-year averages across both of those categories of injuries. These are staff injuries. And this is across DCT. This doesn't mean that we're done, because having one good year isn't a trend. And so this is a continued focus. Another thing that I know that Marshall has put a lot of effort into in the short time that he's been here to try to address safety issues. But this is a continuing challenge that we really want to continue to keep this downward trend. This obviously makes a difference, too, going back to recruitment and retention of staff. If staff are in an environment where they're feeling like they're safe and they're not experiencing a violence, it's going to be much easier to retain staff and keep good staff to serve our patients.
Excuse me, Commissioner Johnson. Representative Johnson has a question.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner Johnson, this is an area that I've been deeply concerned in. As most of us know, And I don't know, I haven't heard the status of the OSHA investigation going into the injuries down there at the security hospital, but it also deals with the safety of the staff throughout the state system. Do you have any idea when the OSHA investigation is going to be done, so we can look at those issues, so we can work on trying to resolve some of those issues?
Commissioner Johnson.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to ask Carol Olson to come down and help with that question. She's been much more involved in these issues than I.
Commissioner
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Olson.
Hi, my name is Carol Olson. I'm the executive director for Forensic Services, chair and representative. We had an active OSHA citation that we've worked on for about 2 years, and it was resolved and closed with OSHA last spring. We do have a current active investigation that OSHA is doing, and we have a closing conference tomorrow.
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner Johnson, as a follow-up on that, I'm glad to see the numbers of the injuries going down. It's a good trend. But I also have concerns about some reports I've had from staff, not just in my area, but across the state. I don't know what the status is. I haven't been able to confirm it, but it's the same remark I get no matter where I go across the state, that the employees are encouraged not to report any assaults or injuries on them. And I don't know if this is going on. I don't know if it's where they are getting their information from, but I think it's something that you might want to look into, because if they're not safe in their work or feel safe there, and they're being told not to report the assaults to law enforcement, that could skew these numbers, and I want to make sure that our staff is safe.
Commissioner Johnson or Ms. Olson?
So first, reporting assaults to the police is a staff can do that, and we would never stand in the way of that. In terms of reporting injuries to us, we encourage that, and we encourage staff to go out and seek medical attention if they're injured, and support them through that. So I'm not sure where you're getting that report, but it's there's a lot of encouragement to fill out first reports of injury, to go seek medical attention, take if the doctor is requiring you to be off work, light duty, to support that.
Just a follow-up comment. The only reason I brought it up, because I've heard this at more than one location, and not just in my area, but across the state.
And Ms. Olson, maybe just to clarify before you step off, what the differences are between an injury, so if a staff member has a scuffle trying to, get involved with a situation where there's not medical treatment versus one where there is medical treatment and then it becomes reportable. Could you talk about the difference between the two and where that line is?
Yes. So we have first reports of injuries that we ask staff to fill out. If they've been involved in an incident, and even if they have a bruise or a scratch, because you never know what that might lead to. So any assault that occurs to a staff from a patient or a slip or a fall, we ask them to fill out a first report of injury. If they need to go seek medical attention, then it becomes potentially a workers' comp. A workers' comp would be those that they lose time at work and or have medical costs, so that becomes a workers' comp. OSHA recordable is defined by several different criteria, and I know that I'm going to miss some of them, but it's when someone receives more than first aid care or treatment at a medical facility. That is sort of that threshold. So we divide our data by first reports of injury, by workers' comp, by OSHA recordable, and we also look at OSHA recordable that's caused by a patient assault.
Thanks, and I think that's an important distinction. Tomorrow we're going to talk to some folks from the unions representing the workers, so that's always a hot topic for us to be discussing. So that's it's perfect timing for you to be here today. Representative Grunhagen.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple quick questions. One is, if a patient assaults a staff member and breaks the law legally, can they be sent back to prison for that assault?
Ms. Olson?
Yeah. So I think it was two legislative sessions ago, Minnesota Security Hospital was added to the legislative language that talked about fourth-degree assaults and applying them to the staff that work in Minnesota Security Hospital. That language had been there for the Minnesota Sex Offender Program, not for Minnesota Security Hospital, and is now included in that language. So if an assault occurs at that fourth-degree level, we evaluate whether we move it forward to be prosecuted, and that's we work with both our Office of Special Investigations as well as Nicollet County Attorney's Office and St. Peter Police Department to make that determination.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Grunhagen.
Okay, I know Representative Hillstrom had introduced a bill, and I signed on to it as a co-author. I never found out if it actually got implemented or not, but appreciate that. The other quick question is that does the staff, are they given any type of device that they can use to defend themselves if they are assaulted by one of the patients while they're at work?
So we have lots and lots of training that we do, and we have lots of different pieces of equipment that staff are trained on that they can use. Both, it's always around imminent risk, and when is someone feeling that they're at imminent risk? It doesn't mean that a staff has to be hurt in order to proceed, but if they feel like imminent risk is present, then there is lots of different tools, so to speak, that staff can use.
Mr. Chair, just a final comment.
Representative Grunhagen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, the reason I say is because my oldest granddaughter is going to go off to college next year, and I bought her a damsel in defense, okay, not in distress, in defense, little handheld taser, okay? And it will put you on the ground in about 1 second. It'll make you unconscious in 5 seconds, okay? And she has, you know, I haven't seen it in use. I just watched the video. But, you know, personally, I don't want staff to be in danger either. And if they're constantly being oppressed, one or two examples like that might make a big change in behavior in some of the patients. Anyway, just my thoughts. Thank you.
Representative Considine. I think we'll go to Representative Considine, and then we'll let the commissioner finish the slides. I want to make sure that he gets through the next couple slides before we have additional questions. Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Johnson, I have been in contact with the security counselors at the security hospital on a fairly regular basis, and they feel pretty free to contact me anytime. And there has never been any indication that they have been told not to report injuries, at least at the security hospital. I'm not sure where else. And like I said, I doubt seriously that they would hesitate to tell me that if it was that was happening.
All right, and we will have labor here tomorrow. Representative Hamilton?
Well, on that same thought process, is there any pay? Is it based on any incentive pay or punitive pay based on injury reporting?
Ms. Olson?
No.
No, okay.
All right, Commissioner Johnson.
Thank you, and thanks. I do want to say that if there is an issue with reporting, that's definitely something we would want to follow up on because that's a basis of anything else we do. If we don't have the reports, we can't improve. So moving on, we had an issue, as I mentioned earlier, with our Minnesota State-Operated Community Services, or MSOCs, area of the budget last year where we had a deficiency running that we estimated for the 2016-17, but it says 16-16 on the slide, I guess, but it was 2016-17 biennium of $28 million, and that funding was provided by the legislature. What had happened here was a number of things. So this is an enterprise service, meaning we're operating essentially in the same environment as other providers who are providing residential-based care to people with disabilities. And so, you know, banded rates, I think those of you that have been around are familiar with the disability waiver rate system know what I'm talking about there, but that actually hit us, too, in terms of some of our homes where we weren't able to maintain a rate through the disability rate system that allowed us to actually meet the cost of those, and so that was definitely one driver. Residential vacancies in the transition that we discussed earlier of trying to move the homes to a more safety net, we ended up with some homes where we had one, two, three individuals and have all four beds filled. That created revenue loss for us. And then we are experiencing low vocational service rates, historically low, and so we needed to address vocational issues. So those were issues that led to the request that we brought last year. I want to talk a little bit about some of the progress that we've made so far in addressing that deficit and bringing ourselves to a position where we can have a sustainable future going forward for the MSOX program, and this will be something we'll also talk more about when after the governor's budget comes out. So first of all, increasing rates for residential crisis homes. We run crisis homes. We weren't getting a rate that was covering those. We worked and got an exception rate to allow us to provide a rate for crisis homes that meets the cost of running a crisis home. Crisis homes, because the beds aren't always filled, they're there for when there's a crisis, and need a special rate in order to cover the cost of maintaining those homes and staffing, even when we're not actually having actively someone in a crisis. Converting intermediate care facilities to adult foster care. This is an initiative we're in the process of right now. We run several intermediate care facilities, which are kind of a step down from a nursing home, which was a legacy way of caring for people with developmental disabilities. They tend to be disappearing both on our side and in the private sector side. But there are still quite a few that are around, a number of people that are still living in them, and some people who need that level of care. We're converting those over to adult foster care and moving, essentially working with the clients and their families to move them over. It doesn't really change very much for them, but it makes a cost structure and a revenue structure that is more sustainable than having these people in something that we're calling an ICF. The consolidating group homes and targeted discharges are both initiatives that are going to follow that transition from the intermediate care facilities to the adult foster care. Once we see how that settles out, we're going to look at where we have group homes that we can consolidate because we don't have enough people essentially to fill all the beds we need from a revenue purpose in order to maintain a sustainable platform going forward. And then targeted discharges. We have some patients or some individuals in our care who we don't believe need state-operated services level of care and could be cared for in the private sector. And we want to work with those individuals and their families to see if they're open to the idea of being transitioned to another home for care. And this goes to the conversation I had earlier with Representative Loeffler around the transition in this area. And then consolidating vocational programs, this is a way essentially to deal with the lower vocational rates by consolidating those programs. We've consolidated a couple already and are working on, I think, three more that we want to get done by the end of the fiscal year. So these are all the steps that we're taking to try to address the issues that we had in MSOX to keep it as an enterprise program but make it sustainable going forward. One piece that isn't mentioned on the slides but I do want to mention that is a continuing challenge within this area is unlike when you give us an operating adjustment for our staff who are paid for through the general fund, whether our central office staff or the folks who work at Security Hospital or wherever, within the enterprise fund, we don't get any additional adjustment when the contracts are increased and our staff all get raises who provide services in those MSOX homes. So that's an issue that we feel we need to address so that we can ensure that we can keep our staff, continue to pay them, and not get into the cycle where we're running behind and starting to lose revenue and not being able to sustain and having an unsustainable system going forward. So those are the steps that we're taking right now to stabilize MSOX, and we'll bring you back some more on this next week. Mr. Chair, a couple of slides here just on some fiscal trends. 48-hour rule and what that has done. I've talked about this a couple of times already. I'll just add a few items here. We had about 167 admissions last year that were due to the 48-hour rule, and about 131 of those went to ANOCA. So the impact from the 48-hour rule really does mostly hit ANOCA in terms of those patients. And when we prior to having the 48-hour rule, ANOCA got most of its individuals who were referred to us or committed to us from other facilities in the community, from other hospitals, from other providers. Now we're getting more than half of them from jails directly. And so it's really changed the profile of people that we're serving at ANOCA in particular. Overtime cost system-wide, I have a couple slides here that I'll show you just to skip ahead. The first one is Anoka, and the second one is for the Security Hospital, which are the two where we've had sort of the most conversations around overtime. It's a lot of information crammed into this slide, but I tend to focus on just that one kind of straight line that you can see going across it and going a little bit in a down slope for the Anoka slide here. That means that our average percentage of hours that are overtime hours has been going down steadily over the course of the last year at Anoka. And that is good news. It's still a little bit higher than we'd like it to be. If you see, it's a little under 4%. As I said, we've had some issues with clinicians, with nurses and staffing levels within Anoka, so that's had some impact on what's happened with Anoka. But that's been generally a positive trend. The Security Hospital is a little bit different. It's a little bit of an upward trend, close to flat. But also, if you look at that right axis and you see those percentages, you know, we're a little over 6% of our hours at overtime hours. That's certainly higher than we would want to have at any of our facilities. And so that's an area where we need to continue to do work. And that's, you know, and partly a function of staff turnover and partly a function of having more acuity in staff and having to have more one-on-one and two-on-one kind of staffing. And a fair FMLA impact as well on our staff and our facilities of individuals, both who may be out because they're suffering some kind of a sickness or a chronic issue, and also our younger employees who are getting pregnant and going on an FMLA. So that, those impacts have actually been felt in terms of pushing our overtime. So just to go back up to this slide and hit a couple more issues, increased workers' compensation costs, again, a somewhat older workforce. You tend to get more of those costs. We're spending about $500,000 per month now on workers' comp. We're working on various strategies to bring that down going forward. I mentioned clinician turnover, but the fiscal impact of that is that we often bring in contract staff. Contracted psychiatrists and others who cost us more than having our own employees. So we've been very intentional about our recruitment around clinicians, particularly psychiatrists, to get ourselves staffed up. And I know we have a couple. We're very hopeful in the pipeline for Anoka coming on this year. The rules around Olmstead Positive Support Rule, Jensen, particularly doing three-year reviews of everyone who is committed to us as MIND, that's a pressure that we've absorbed within our work. That we do in the forensics program. And then, as I mentioned before, the staffing levels at the Security Hospital that we believe need to be brought up in order to address better client, better patient care, as well as safety issues in that facility. And then a few more on the fiscal trends, drivers, and pressures. Staff recruitment and retention, just sort of generally speaking, we are pretty competitive on salaries for doctors, psychiatrists. We're not as competitive for nurses. We're $5 to $7 an hour lower. Often nurses have a lot of options in today's healthcare market. They get better hours at community hospitals often than they can working for us. That's been a challenge for us, is maintaining our nursing staff. The healthcare market is very robust right now. There's a lot of hiring. There's a lot of competition to get people. We certainly are competing with the private sector when it comes to nurses and other folks in care. But also when you get to some of the other classes, we have the security counselors and human service technicians, we're competing with a lot of other employers. Then they can go a lot of other places to work. And, again, it goes to the work environment, the pay, the benefits, what we can offer them. We also have trouble with hospital administrators, administrative level. I think Marshall and I have worked together in maybe 3 months now. We've had probably three conversations about different hospital administrators where he said, based on his private sector experience, you know, we're not offering enough to be able to get the candidate in that we want. And we're still finding good candidates because we're working at it, but those salaries are often a challenge for us. We talked about community preparation services at the sex offender program. As we increase that census, and we have 89 now and we're maxed out, we need to have more staff to work with those individuals as well. In St. Peter, working with them outside of the perimeter, so we kind of having these three separate programs within MSOP create staffing pressure if people shift from one place to another within the system. We have security upgrade needs across a number of our facilities, more cameras, better person down systems, upgrades in terms of locking systems on doors and keys and how we manage those. That is a key pressure that we're managing somewhat to the extent we can, but again, something we will need some help in order to get ourselves to where we want to be for a 2017 facility operation. I've talked about phase two of the bonding proposal. Just very specifically, for Security Hospital and the sex offender program at St. Peter, we obviously anticipated we would have a two-phase proposal, meaning we knew there'd be some time between the first part of construction and the second part of construction. But, of course, our hope was that would just be 2 years. We got the first chunk of money in 2014, and we hopefully would have gotten the appropriation for phase two in 2016. It just kind of extends that out. So those of you that have been to the Security Hospital since we got the new part opened up know we have kind of this really new part and we have this really old part, and we're going to have a lot of transitional time of having those two parts of the facility in which we're caring for different people operating at the same time without having the opportunity to do the renovation and remodeling to the old part that would make it seem like one big facility, really get us to the type of a care and therapeutic environment that we want for people, the different ways to manage people within different parts of the facility who have different needs. So that extending out that period of time between the phases impacts us. And for the sex offender program, a lot just has to do with that community preparation services, just needing more beds outside the perimeter on St. Peter to address that pressure for more beds in that program.
Thanks, Commissioner Johnson. And I think we're going to get to that when we get through the bonding requests. Representative Luden had a question.
Yeah, back a couple slides, you had mentioned about increased workers' comp costs. Do you self-insure for work comp, or do you actually go out and purchase coverage?
Commissioner Johnson. Mr. Chair, the state is self-insured.
So you don't have so in a normal, you don't have access to in a work comp situation. Typically, a carrier or whoever's administrating it for you would come out and do an evaluation or a risk evaluation and make recommendations or and help implement procedures to keep down the cost of the work comp. Is the increased work comp cost have to do with an increase in claims?
Commissioner Johnson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lunan, I don't know the exact analysis of what's driving all the costs. I know we have more claims, and I know some of the claims are bigger. The health care costs that we're getting on some of the claims are bigger than we have seen in the past as well. So to your general question, my understanding, and I'm not an expert on workers' comp within the state, is that we would work with MMB on those issues because they are kind of like the HR and handle those items across the state as to how we can work on improving.
And in work comp, when there's a work comp loss, there are statutes that come into play as far as, I mean, there's parameters as far as what can be charged, fee schedules, things like that. So the increased medical cost, I would be curious to see that data. And then you're talking about the severity of the claims, why the claims would increase. I'm just wondering if it's an increase in the number of claims or the dollar amount of the claims. Because, again, when you have a work comp claim, they've got treatment standards and fee schedules that kick in.
Mr. Representative Luden, we can certainly get you more information around the claims.
Thank you.
And what's happening with them.
Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm not sure if this is an answer to your question. When I worked there, they had a, you just wrote, IOD, injured on duty, and you got paid, and you didn't file a work comp. And I think they have phased that out now, or do you still do that? We would just, like I say, write IOD on it, and you were out for a couple of days. Is that still a practice?
Commissioner Johnson.
Mr. Chairman, of Considine, not that I'm aware of, but I could maybe Carol or someone would know an answer to that.
Seeing no other questions, thank you, Commissioner. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Schultz, we have one more.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I went to the website where you can see bed capacity for mental health beds in the state, and I noticed that there was almost no capacity in the state, which is updated every day. So I'm wondering, do you know how many more beds we need for mental health for children, adolescents, and adults in the state? And why do you think the private sector is not stepping up to offer those beds?
Commissioner Johnson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Schultz, I don't know the answer to that question. I'm not sure that anybody has an answer. I've heard different answers to the question. I know it's one that the Mental Health Task Force talked some about, but I don't think they arrived with an exact plan either. We certainly came to the conclusion when we brought forward our proposals last year that we needed to have more beds within the state-operated system because we weren't seeing them elsewhere, and that's what led to the staffing up of the CDHHs and trying to relieve pressure in Anoka and St. Peter. But I think, from my view, it would be very helpful to know if there's a way to get a better read on where we should be as a state. It's all interrelated with what the continuum looks like, though, right? Because, you know, we have beds in Anoka that could be open for psychiatric care that we have people that don't need hospital-level psychiatric care, right? And if we didn't have them in there, we could have more people there. So you have to look at the system as a whole in order to understand, you know, and this kind of goes into the question that Representative Dean asked earlier about, you know, where do we really need to have the beds, and I don't know that we have the best analysis around that. I would say with children, you know, certainly we view CABS as being helpful in terms of a hospital level of care. We also are bringing online the psychiatric residential treatment facilities, which were approved, I think, in the 2015 legislature, which is a step-down residential level of care for children. And we have 50 beds I think we're going to have up hopefully by July. And so that will help, I think. That's been a pressure area where Minnesota sends a lot of our kids to other states because we don't have the bed capacity.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So in the Duluth community, we have a task force to look at mental health because we've had individuals in our hospital ER for hundreds of days because we don't have anywhere to refer them to. So we have everyone in the community, providers, the police, our psychologists, coming together to find a solution. And I think what they've identified is that we need a triage center in Duluth. And I'm wondering if you know of any other communities that are convening these community task force on mental health.
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Schultz, I know that the Mankato area is doing quite a bit of work with Blue Earth County around trying to examine similarly in their community what the needs are. And I think other communities are doing it to different degrees. I'm not sure exactly as to what you're looking at in Duluth, and I'm not sure how many different solutions we've come up with in the regions across the state. But I could get someone in the mental health area to give a better answer to that. I'm just not sure what else is going on.
Thank you. And tomorrow, members, we're going to continue the discussion on direct care and treatment and have additional testimony on treatment and impacts on patients, families, and hospitals. I want to thank everybody for participating in today's hearing as well as yesterday's. I thought it was really good and good participation, good testifiers, and I really appreciate members being here. For overviews, I know there's no bills up and there's a lot of pressure on your time, so I really do appreciate members being here. With that, we're adjourned until tomorrow.